I do it for the beauty. And that's usually where they lose me. That's not music. You're using that term too loosely. I can see you tiptoeing on a tightrope. And you don't listen, that's all right though. Just keep tweaking. I can hear these trees speaking. And tell me where the light goes at night when the high's low. And everything's chill because I feel like a light show. And money makes the world go psycho. I wonder why these girls so ice cold. Says the snowman, he really gives no damn. He did it for show and won't admit it. Yeah, I know. Time is a wheel on a steel plate. Life isn't real, let's see real.
My name is Nathan Boko, and today I'm going to be interviewing my friend Eric Coburn. Eric is a software engineer and a UX designer at the developer Serenity Forge in Boulder, Colorado.
Hey, how's it going?
To get started, we're going to talk a little bit about you, kind of contextualize the rest of the conversation by talking a little bit about your experiences and how you approach games. I mentioned that you're a game developer. When did you get started developing games?
I guess when I really started making games goes all the way back to when I was around 10 or 12 and I was just screwing around in Flash making games for fun. And I did that for quite a while until I decided to really get serious about it, started publishing things online and trying to get myself noticed. Just last year, actually, some people from Serenity Forge ended up finding me and asked if I wanted to interview for a position, so jumped on that, and I've been working with them since last July.
Going back a little bit, do you want to throw out the names of any of the games you did while you were working in Flash? Are any of those still out there to check out?
I only put a couple games out, but I'd say the two that I'm most happy with would be... The first one would be Don't Wake Up, which is just a very basic platformer built around the story of this kid and exploring a dreamscape, basically.
That's the one that got you noticed by Serenity Forge in the first place, right?
Yes. Yes, it was. Then the other game, which I was actually pretty proud of, was... It was one of the games where you're a little blob and you eat smaller blobs and get bigger and you can eat more stuff. Super simple game, but it was kind of a turning point for me in game development because it was the first game I made exclusively with code. I didn't use any art assets or anything like that. It was just me and a text editor, basically.
So what was it like to go from developing on your own, doing Flash stuff, to stepping into being a really organized developer at an actual company?
It was pretty jarring at first, because yeah, I'm used to doing absolutely everything on my own. And before Serenity Forge, I tried working with a different group of people. And with them, it kind of got to the point where, again, I basically ended up taking over and doing everything myself. So when I joined Serenity Forge, and it was a group of people I could actually count on, and they got things done, and it just worked so well, it was kind of a surreal feeling for quite a while there.
Now that you've adapted more, what would you say the office culture is like? People there love games, obviously. Are there games that you guys look to for models? Or are there things about games that you guys are especially focused on or talk about around the office?
I guess the one central focus we all share is we look for games that challenge the way people think. We really look at the games that, yeah, they mix up the formula, they tweak things in ways people haven't thought to do. That's what we shoot for in our own projects as well. But as far as the group's personal interest in games, it's incredibly diverse. Like, we have a bunch of people that enjoy games like Dota, we have some people playing World of Warcraft, we got StarCraft players, Smash Bros. Players, and it really spreads out between all the different genres with all of us there.
Is there any kind of shared literacy for game studies, game theory, the kind of things we're talking about in this class in the office, or is it more focus on technical know-how?
It's really a decent balance between both of them, I'd say. I wouldn't say there's any specific literature. It's just we get together and we discuss game theory from time to time, look at different games, see what they did well, see what we agree with, things like that.
I know you guys went and saw Ian Bogus give a talk, right?
Oh, yes. That was a while ago. Trying to remember what the topic was. I think it was irony in games was the topic. And it was really interesting because he went on to describe how... One of his key points was just how much the game industry is changing and yet how much people want it to either stay the same or keep changing. And there's this dichotomy in what people say they want and what they actually want, and it never seems to match up. And so the difficulty with the game design is basically treading that line there.
No, I'm jealous. He's one of the big, like, kind of the people who started this whole field of game studies, and he's kind of a titan in it.
Yeah.
Last thing before we move on to talking about the game you played, what games have you worked on at Serenity Forge?
So far, the only game that we ourselves have put out that I've worked on has been Pixel Galaxy, which that's available on Steam right now, and we'll be demoing that at GDC in actually 2 weeks from now. But in addition to that, I've mainly just been working on contract work, NDA kind of things, and got to work with some neat technology too. I can say that we're building a lot of things involving Kinect, and the Kinect games are going to be played on just these massive walls, basically.
The topic of this interview is reaching out to someone outside of the class, talking about one of the games we played, and getting their perspective on it, seeing what people outside of this, like, heavily academic realm think. I give you the list of games to look through, and we ended up settling on Braid. So had you played Braid before I asked you to play it for this interview?
I have played it before, and it was actually one of my favorite games for quite a while, and I kind of got into speedrunning it at one point as well.
Doing the PAR system that's built in?
Yeah. Cool. Well, it started there, but then I started finding a handful of little exploits and around for other stuff, and it's really neat when you get into speedrunning something like that, because as you find the exploits, it really makes the game feel a lot more transparent, and it's not so much that you're breaking it, but you're starting to see things. You're seeing things in a way the developer didn't necessarily see them.
Can you talk about some of those exploits specifically?
I guess the biggest one is at the very end where you're running to get to the princess. And oh, if you collect all of the stars, then there's this one area that's timed slightly differently and you're able to actually reach the princess and you get the secret ending. But you can actually get that without having all the stars if you have pixel perfect timing in most of that section. And if Wow. you get it just right, you can barely miss the thing that would otherwise block you reaching her, and you can get the secret ending without collecting all the stars.
Played it again recently. How did your impression of it differ from the first time you played it?
Well, the first time I played it, it definitely had almost a magical feel to it for me, just with the art style and the subtle storytelling, I'd say. And it all just blended in a really interesting way for me. And coming back to it, once I know the story and I know the art style and everything, I see it much more for its mechanics rather than its story now. And the mechanics, I feel like they are definitely the strong point of it, but the story really, it kind of overshadows that at times. And it's only after you really get in the game that you start seeing the intricacies of how it works together.
I mean, there's this concept that's been thrown around for a long time called ludonarrative dissonance. Do you think this game suffers from that at all, or do you think even if one overshadows the mechanics and the narrative work well together?
That is definitely a tricky thing in a lot of games, and I think Braid really suffers from it, honestly, because the story is told in between gameplay. It's told through blocks of text, and you just get, it's a text dump is what it feels like. And so it really, it puts a halt to the gameplay, and it almost takes you out of the experience a lot of the times. But it's something that people have worked on since games became a medium to tell stories, and it's definitely an area that will be improved on for many years to come.
Speaking as a developer, do you think there's a different way that he could have handled that to make it more integrated and less, you know, chunky, like gameplay narrative?
The last level, I think, captured it the best, where you get kind of what the story is through the events of that final level, where at first it seems like you need to rescue the princess from this guy, and then it rewinds and you see the truth of things. And that's the only time in the game where the story is told through the gameplay instead of through the books and journals you find. So I'm kind of thinking maybe something more along the lines of how Bastion did it, where you have the narrator going through. But even that, the narration is kept kind of separate from the gameplay itself, and they don't necessarily line up.
At least you're experiencing them, like, temporally at the same time. They're overlapping.
Yeah, yeah.
One thing I wanted to go back to before we move on, again, speaking to your perspective as a developer, you mentioned there are certain exploits you can do while speedrunning that it seems like even the developer didn't recognize. When you're developing, or when just looking at this game, how could a developer anticipate that, or how do those things get overlooked?
A lot of times, I don't know if it's necessarily them being overlooked, because there are a lot of games where the speedrun routes are something that's kept in mind. And I think Sonic would be the perfect example of that, where you have the levels that flow really well if you're just going through them, but if you're speedrunning it, you can skip over these massive sections, and it still flows just as seamlessly. So that would be a great example of a game built with speedrunning in mind. But with something like Braid, where there is technically the speedrunning mode, and you find these little things that allow you to skip ahead, I don't think it's ever been seen as a bad thing, because the speedrunners, they look for things like that in games, and if they can't find anything, then there isn't a lot of optimization you can do, and it kind of dies within the speedrunning community. But on the other hand, as a developer, it's really kind of cool to see people find tricks like that in your games that you haven't seen.
It's a good thing. It adds dimension to it, it adds replayability, it helps to build a community around your game and things like that.
Yeah.
You mentioned, we were talking a little bit about the narrative. The game kind of sustains multiple narrative threads. It's got this thing going on about the Manhattan Project. Part of it kind of reads as like a damsel in distress story. Is there one of those threads that you really engaged with, or one that it seemed most sustainable to you?
Honestly, the whole metaphor for the atomic bomb and that whole thing, it felt a little forced, but going back through the game and you see basically the intertwining stories of the romance and the Manhattan Project, you can really see how the project itself was a romantic thing for the people involved in a lot of the cases. And when you look at it that way, the stories really work well, a lot better together. And there's that one quote at the end where, what was it? Now we are all sons of bitches. If I remember correctly, that line coincides with the princess basically escaping you, and you can really see how the two work well together in that context.
So you read them as like distinct arcs, you don't necessarily see one as a metaphor for the other or anything like that?
Not initially. It feels like that could have been done a bit better, but the two stories, they are compatible, it's just there's some little piece missing to connect them.
That makes sense to me, because it does kind of come out of nowhere at the end, and yep. It really throws you for a loop a little bit. You can see it more if you come back and play it again, then you're like, oh, yeah, this is all building to this, but initially it really seems like it comes out of left field.
Yeah, even the opening scene, it's a destroyed city. The game takes place in the aftermath of the bombings.
But you just have no way to contextualize that when you're jumping into it. What do you think, from a dev perspective specifically, the game does well or does poorly?
The mechanics themselves were absolutely the strong point of the game. And with each level, they had different little gimmicks they would use and ways to slow down time or reverse time or time moves as you do. And each one of those, I feel like a lot of games have tried to use a handful of different mechanics like that, and it just kind of falls flat because they don't have enough time to develop each one of the mechanics on their own. But when Braid does it, each one is simple enough that the whole level where that mechanic is involved, it gets fully developed and the mechanic doesn't really overstay its welcome at all. So you get this taste of these tools that you can use, and by the time you're accustomed to them and you're happy using them, then you are thrown into something else shortly after that.
But it also does the neat thing of coming back to them and recontextualizing them with new time mechanics in each world.
So it does build upon itself, but the way it introduces the new things, it always keeps you in this perpetual state of learning how to play the game.
Do you think there's anything it does poorly from a dev perspective?
It doesn't feel like what most people would be saying about it, but I do feel like the story was absolutely the weak point of it, just because of how it's told. The story is, as a developer, it's one of my biggest focus in games, and I'm always looking for ways it can be done better, and I have yet to find a game that really nails it flawlessly. So I wouldn't really say that's a negative point for Braid. I mean, Braid, it's an old game at this point, and as far as the indie scene goes. And at the time, it was definitely a step in the right direction.
How does your perspective on those two things, what it does well and what it does poorly, differ when you think about it as a player as opposed to thinking about it as a developer?
That's a tricky question for me personally, because for as long as I've been playing games, I've been looking at them from the viewpoint of a developer. Yeah, as a player, I tend to overlook all of the things that I don't like, because games are meant to be enjoyable, and if you get hung up on the things that you don't like, then I kind of feel like there's no point to it at that point. Playing through the game, my core focus most of the time ended up just being the gameplay, because that is what I enjoyed.
So next, I want to do a little bit deeper dive into some of the theory stuff, some of the stuff I've been learning about in class, and kind of see if this resonates with you at all in your experiences. One of the big things, one of the big theoretical tools that we use in class was this idea by Sicard called player subjectification. It says that games are power structures, and they exercise varying degrees of power on the player in terms of saying, you have this role, you have these abilities, you have these motivations. And I think that's especially interesting in linear games, like Braid, as opposed to like open world games. What do you think about that idea, and do you think that applies to Braid?
I feel like the levels in Braid are set up very well, so it doesn't ever feel like it's restrictive, because the solution is always incredibly satisfying to find in that game. And aside from the mechanics that it actually introduces, the level design of it is probably some of the best I've seen. Yeah, the puzzles, it makes you feel rewarded for figuring something out, and in a lot of cases, it feels like maybe that wasn't the intended solution. It feels kind of like you might be doing something that the developer didn't quite expect. And I know, back to the speedrunning stuff, there's a handful of techniques that you can see people doing that it gets you through levels way faster than you probably got through it yourself on just a casual playthrough. And to kind of build off of that, just the ability to manipulate time, it will always give players a feeling of having way more control whether or not they actually do. And that just works really well with the level design that they have in Braid.
Yeah, I think in a lot of games, death or health, you know, getting your character hurt is kind of a way of the game communicating, you did this wrong, you aren't working within the system. And it kind of subverts that in a really interesting way. I also think your point about the speedrunning and how that's explicitly supported by the system, because it has these par times built in, is really interesting. It's almost like Blow has anticipated these counter-gaming or anti-gaming impulses that some people have, and he's given them the tools to do it instead of having them try to break his system.
It's like he encourages players to find the holes in the system.
Yeah. Talk about a lot of different forms of that. Yeah, speedrunning's a big one, because a lot of games, they want you to go through things at a certain pace. They have signs for you to read. They've got these long pathways for you to explore. I think Braid's a really interesting example of where he's honed it down to just getting through the game. He didn't allow a lot of, like, explorative potential. It's more about the player, how they can think of the puzzles, and there's that exploration without a lot of it being explicitly represented in the game world.
Yeah. Just with the structure of the game it is and the genre it's in, exploration is, it's not really something you can include in a puzzle platformer like Braid. Like, if you just look at the secrets, those right there encourage the exploration. And it's more than you would get in a lot of games in the same genre, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good game to talk about in terms of this, because John Blow, he's a pretty smart guy. He seems to really have keyed in on what players want, what they expect, what their impulses are, and he's kind of cherry-picked the parts that he's really interested in and encouraged those, and there's other parts that you could read it as he's either, like, taking them down or offering an argument against them. The Star, where you've got to wait for, like, 2 hours. A lot of people have read that as a takedown of achievements that are just grind this for the achievement.
And that is a really controversial thing he did with that one, too, because, sure, it's a commentary on achievements and everything like that, but there are still people that want to achieve everything in the game, and they will have to put up with that just because John Blow wanted to make this commentary on it.
I seem to remember at the time it came out, there was a lot of almost like outrage about it. People were like, this is such a dumb thing. This is a waste of my time. Why does he want to subject me to this? Yeah, you really have to understand where he's coming from and what his position on things like achievements are to kind of get what he's saying.
And I do feel like there was a better way he could have had that same effect. There's a Flash game called Achievement Unlocked. It's just filled with all of these stupid, really easy, really trivial achievements. And it gets that same point across of just how useless achievements are and what you go through to get them. And with that, it's still fun for the player because they still get to play the game. They don't have to wait or grind or anything. It's just kind of a funny thing for everyone involved, whereas the way John Blow did it, it's really, I kind of feel bad using this word, but it's a blow against the players, just so he can establish that almost satirical design there.
It's one of the criticisms he's kind of sustained, especially since he's been doing talks and things since Braid came out. People say he's a little bit pretentious or condescending or outright contemptuous of the AAA industry and some of these best practices.
And actually, shortly after Braid came out, he would be going around forums where people would be talking about their interpretations of the game and everything, and he would just be arguing with them, explaining how it's actually meant to be portrayed. And
that was part of the big blowback to Indie Game the movie. I remember people talking about him being frustrated by people not understanding his work and being like, oh, boo-hoo, you sold a million units of your indie game and people don't understand you.
Since that was his first major success, it's totally understandable where he's coming from, but as a developer, you really want to basically separate yourself from your work as far as things like that are regarded. When you build a story like that, I mean, it's up to the players to interpret it, and that in itself is almost a game.
It's the biggest challenge you hear about with all kinds of different artists. They put something out and people love it, but it doesn't have the same significance to the audience that it does to the creator, and they have to resolve that in themselves.
And the tricky thing is, people will never have the same appreciation for it that the original creator does. And you're not going to be able to convey that aside from the product itself.
The work has to speak for itself. You can talk about the theory around it, and you can talk about the industry as a whole, but a person's experience with a game, you know, that's a really unique thing. That's something that only exists between that player and that game at that moment. Another idea from class that I wanted to move on to and talk about a little bit is this idea of different types of interactivity. Katie Salen and Eric Zimmerman have this multivalent model of interactivity. They've got explicit interactivity, which is like ergodic action, jumping, solving puzzles, moving through the world. There's functional interactivity, which is like settings and pause screens. Beyond the object interactivity, which is community that goes around something, like fan art, strategy guides. And then the fourth one, and the one that John Blow seems most interested in Braid especially, but even in The Witness, I think this is true. Cognitive inactivity. It's you sitting there and looking at the problem space in front of you and working it out in your head before you actually take any action against it.
I feel like both him and Phil Fish definitely used that one the most, where, especially in Fez, the majority of the game takes place with pen and paper. You're writing things down, you're figuring out in front of you. It's not even including the game. There was a community that was built around a lot of the puzzles in that game, just to decipher every little thing they included. To an extent, I'd say that John Blow did the same thing with Braid, although that was much more story-oriented and less puzzle-oriented.
People interpreting the narrative was more of the cognitive interactivity than solving the puzzles was.
I would say so, yeah.
That makes sense to me, because if you work at it long enough, you can brute force some of the puzzles just by trying every single avenue available to you. Whereas there are no explicit answers for the story as much. You just gotta mull it over in your own head, pick the threads that it offers to you that work for you personally.
And that seems to be a trend with John Blow, because with The Witness, too, it seems like the thing he really enjoys doing is creating these intricate, multi-layered stories. Now that he figured out how to work with the community, he's not explaining it anymore. So he's kind of putting that out there and letting the community decipher what the actual meaning is.
You don't want to read too much about an individual, you know, developer based on their work. Like, you've got the beginner's guide that's a huge takedown of that whole idea, you know? But it really does seem like there's been kind of this growth and this change in Blow. You just look at the way he talks to audiences now and the way he really reached out to the community to test The Witness. And it seems like he learned a lot from the process of Braid and going through that heartbreak of people, like, not understanding it. For you as a developer, what do you think of this multivalent idea of interactivity? Is that something you ever really think about? You know, Pixel Galaxy is a very action-oriented game. Do you like this idea of cognitive interactivity? Is that something you like to explore?
I would love to explore it more. I've always wanted to build games where it's very much dependent on the player's interpretation of things, and it's an experience that becomes very personal for each individual person that touches it. And love to create that kind of experience for as many people as I can, basically.
I think looking back to some of the Flash games you made when you were just getting started, narratively especially, those are really asking a lot of the player in terms of interpretation and thinking more abstractly about the game presented. One thing I wanted to talk about a little bit was this idea of expressive elements. We talked a lot about the art of the gaming class. You've got the flags, which you look into like maritime culture, and they actually have meanings. Like, one of them is, I'm trying to communicate, stop what you're doing. You've also got these callbacks to other platformers. A lot of it's kind of referential to Mario as the cultural myth of games. Like, everybody knows Bowser, and every boss is going to be compared to Bowser a little bit. Is that something that you enjoyed? Is that something that you really picked up from the game? Or do you think it stands better on its own? Do you think Braid benefits from all these callbacks?
It was definitely a neat touch, but I feel like I'm speaking as a lifelong gamer. There was a sense of nostalgia just from like the subtle Mario references here and there, but as a whole, those references, well, they weren't overbearing or anything, so they didn't really get in the way, but I feel like they didn't really add much either. So to the average player of the game, it's not going to mean a whole lot unless these are influential things for you. And even then, it's just like a slight little nod. You might get a slight chuckle out of it, but that's about it.
One thing that's important when you're looking at these things is thinking about the time it came out, when indie culture and a lot of this culture of game critique wasn't as developed. For me personally, I read it as kind of saying, this is how games used to be done. This is the best practices of games, and trying to call attention that he was subverting it in some ways.
That's a good point.
With castles and everything, you think about how Mario dies, and you've got to start over compared to Braid, where you just rewind time, Tim gets another shot at it.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting from like a subversive perspective. We talked a lot about how he's explicitly, as a developer, going out there and critiquing best practices in games. You know, he's got that famous talk where he just rips into World of Warcraft. And it's kind of interesting to see some of that rejection and some of that really explicit disagreement coming out in the game design.
I feel like, to an extent, though, if you let things like that influence your game design too much, then it starts feeling a lot more like it's more of a commentary than a game, I think would be a good way to put it. If you feel too strongly about something while you're making a game and it slips into the game design like that, it could be a slippery slope there.
Where it's almost better to be subversive and just go out and do it. Don't say, hey, I'm being subversive, look at this.
Yeah.
Think about your old games and throw them out because I'm the new hotness.
Yeah.
I think there's a place for commentary. We've seen a huge influx of games about games recently with Stanley Parable, Beginner's Guide, Magic Circle. A whole bunch of indies are at least having that conversation right now. But there does have to be a line, I think. It has to exist on its own merits without going nuts and just being a critique of another thing and being dependent on that other thing and knowledge of it.
Even within those games where they're built to be that critique, it's a very meta experience with those. Whereas if you look at a game like Braid, it doesn't really have much of a place for that because Braid is its own thing. It's got its own world and it isn't built to be a commentary on anything other than the story it sets itself up for.
Right, so, it does a great job of justifying its own existence without that commentary as well.
Yeah, so I guess that's the main thing with commentary. It needs to fit in with the game and it needs to work well with what the game itself is already portraying.
The last topic I wanted to talk about is this idea of indie. Obviously, Braid was, you know, you have Indie Game the Movie, you've got Braid and Super Meat Boy, and a couple of others. Limbo is kind of kicking off this big indie game revolution.
Minecraft.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it's easy to forget about it now because Microsoft's behind it and you can buy Minecraft action figures now, but at the time it really was pretty bold.
I think Minecraft was one of the first games to be sold before it was finished. It was the first kind of, to use a Steam term, early access game. It was explosively successful.
Thinking about that era in games and how it's kind of changed the landscape, one of the things in class we talked about is the very, very indie developer Anna Anthropy. She wrote this book called Rise of the Video Game Zinesters, talking about how things like Unity coming out, game development's more accessible than ever. People can make games as personal projects in the same way that you might make a piece of art for a person. You can make a personal gift of a game.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting to just consider Braid maybe as contributing to this culture or as exceptional to this culture of the democratization of game making. Maybe Indie Game the Movie is a good place to start. He had a lot of financial resources that people didn't have access to. Maybe that's a good starting point for thinking about Braid relative to other people's indie experience. Is it something that people should aspire to? Is it something that is attainable for the average indie developer? Or is it kind of setting people up with unrealistic expectations?
I feel like any lessons you could take away from Braid, they aren't as relevant now as they were back then, because, as you were saying, it is far more accessible to make games now and it costs far less. But I feel like it is because of games like Braid and Super Meat Boy and all of basically the first indie games. It's all of these games that show it only takes one person, two people, maybe a team of five people to make a good game that people are willing to play. And I know for me personally that those games were a very big determining factor for me in following this kind of career path, because resources or not, it showed it only takes a handful of people to do things like this. And now with Unity and Unreal and everything like that, you have everything you need to make games at your fingertips right there. All you need to do is dive into it and start learning.
So it was really a good moment for you as a game developer, that moment that was captured by Indie Game the Movie happening. Kind of inspirational, kind of empowering to say, yeah, one person, absolutely, two people, five people can do this.
Just in reference to the big AAA teams, it's 500 people, close to 1,000 people in a lot of cases, and it takes them a long time to put out something that it's fun for a bit, but it eventually gets old and no one really cares anymore. And to think that two, three people can make things like Braid or Super Meat Boy, it's really mind-boggling.
And those games still endure to this day. They're still being talked about. Braid's, as far as I've experienced, it's one of the exemplars for looking at game academically and from a critique perspective 7-8 years after the fact.
The storytelling alone of Braid, at the time it was probably the most complex storytelling that has been in the game, and considering that, it worked surprisingly well.
I mean, we talked about it challenging explicitly some of these mechanical practices, but in terms of narrative, it really did some new things too, and it was a lot sneakier about that. I mean, it references, like, the damsel in distress thing to some degree, but it's really going for this multivalent, interweaving story thing. It was really ambitious at the time, even if a AAA game had tried it.
Yeah, I think it's still ambitious now, actually. There are very few games that could pull off something like that.
You can speak to this more. You have experience with Unity. The mechanic stuff is easier to do than ever, I guess, but you got to be able to write. You got to be able to tell a story independent of your technical know-how.
Actually, I feel like I'd almost disagree with that.
Really?
With any art medium, if you're writing books or making a movie or making a game, story is going to be a part of it. And you can make any kind of movie, any kind of game, story is always going to be there. But to really take advantage of the video game medium, you need a lot more than just the story. You really need to take advantage of the gameplay and the core mechanics that only video games can offer. Because the way Braid told the story through just text, it could be a book. They could tell the same story using a book, and it wouldn't be all that different. So it's absolutely helpful to have good storytellers in the game industry, but unless they can make it work with the medium, it isn't going to mean much to the whole community.
Would you argue that, I mean, we talked about how Braid could have done it better before. Would you consider it a negative exemplar of that?
I'd say by today's standards, it isn't the greatest, but back in the day, it was really one of the first to just establish that you can tell these complex stories with a game, and they don't have to be get to the castle, beat Bowser, and save the princess. They don't have to be that simple. You can tell these really complex stories with it. And I think Bioshock Infinite really picked up on that, despite the fact it's not indie or anything. Games have been getting more and more complex with stories, and I don't have anything to base this off of, but I feel like Braid could have been a catalyst for that.
Maybe as an aspirational figure, setting people up to be more ambitious with the storytelling.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely see what you're saying with the Bioshock example. It's bringing in multiple timelines. It's bringing in these interweaving threads that all come together in a really interesting way. Definitely not linear like a lot of game stories before it.
I guess there's something to be said with indies in general, because a lot of indie games, it's made by people in their free time while they work full-time jobs. Because of that, they don't need the financial security of a game that sells well, so they're able to take these crazy risks like this. And then you have the big AAA studios that see these risks, they see that they pay off, and now we can get these massively produced games that take the same kind of risks. So at this point, indies are definitely driving the industry, I'd say.
It's kind of the testing ground from some of these more ambitious things, more experimental things that are happening. From a business perspective, it's unfortunately you've got people working in their free time, not getting paid to try out these challenging things, and then have people who can afford to take the risk after it's been proven to be successful. So we're gonna pick up on the trend.
I would almost say that it's the lack of financial security for the indies, though. I'd kind of consider that a good thing for the game industry, just because the only people that are going to be doing it are doing it because they want to. It is their passion. It's their life, for lack of a better term there. And because they are doing it because they love it, it is going to have way more passion than someone doing it because it's their job.
People take these risks because they feel it's the best way to tell the story or convey the idea that's in their heart, not because they think it'll be the next big thing.
Yeah, exactly.
That actually really gets into the last point I wanted to talk about. Yeah, I mentioned Anianthropy's idea of using a game as a gift or a letter or direct human-to-human communication. We talked about Blow's frustration with Braid and not necessarily conveying his ideas as successfully as he wanted to. What do you think about this idea of this really intimate personal communication, people doing passion projects, doing things about these ideas that they love, and using games as the method for exploring that? It doesn't have to be direct, like, one-to-one communication. It's just more this idea of one person having this very intimate, very personal idea that they need to get out. And then whatever audience it reaches. Or if they just want to share it with a couple people, they can. Looking at Braid generally, and indies more broadly, as this form of expression. What have you seen of that in the industry? What do you think of that? Where do we go from here?
I think the best example I can think of for that is a game that came out pretty recently called That Dragon Cancer. It's this game that was made by this couple after they had a son that ended up dying from cancer at the age of, I want to say it was like 7. And just basically as part of their grieving process, they wanted to make this game to remember him and just remember the struggle and what kind of a kid he was and everything like that. It was an incredibly personal game, and a very big part of it was their own personal religion. So a lot of the game was very much set in Christianity. And there were a lot of people that really didn't like that. They felt that it was really preachy and everything like that. But having met the developers themselves and having talked to them, they are incredibly down-to-earth, very peaceful people. And it was an incredible experience just to talk with the people, knowing what they've been through and how they've been handling. And while it's up for a handful of awards, it sold really well. But with something that personal, whether or not it sells well, at that point isn't going to matter. the more that can be encouraged, the more people will feel like they can just make games, they can make them about anything, they can make it about any personal issue they've ever had, really. And the more that gets out there, the more people are going to be willing to make games, the more people feel it's accessible, and the more people we have driving the industry as a whole because of it.
It was really interesting for me, for that example specifically, to see the backlash on the Steam forums was super bizarre. People were accusing them of profiteering off their kids' death. It does kind of show the other side of the coin. If you make this personal thing and you just let it out into the world, you expose yourself to all kinds of toxicity. You expose yourself to people who are going to be ruthless. Maybe they actually have moral concerns. Maybe they're just trying to troll or trying to tear people down for whatever reason.
One thing the internet does best is hate things. And as a developer, that you just basically have to come to terms with that, because you will never please everyone. There will always be people violently hating on whatever you make. I think that goes for pretty much any creative medium.
It's terrifying, though, from some perspective. I mean, you do your best to steel yourself against it, but if you put something out that's like your life's work, your life's passion, and people decide that it, A, isn't good, or worse, that it's evil.
Especially when it's about something like that dragon cancer's about. It is appalling to see what people will say.
It's fascinating. It really, I think, brings into focus some of the tougher parts of being willing to put that intimate, that personal feeling out there instead of just making something that's cool or experimental or commercially viable.
I can't say I'm all that interested in it just as a gamer, but as a personal creation from a couple of parents here, I want the industry as a whole to encourage more things like that. That is what we need. More than innovation or anything, we need that personal connection.
To loop it around back to Braid, John Blow's very public struggle with this, trying to take something intimate and convey it accurately to people. Do you think that may have been influential at the time, or may have empowered people to be a little bit more adventurous with what they put out there?
I think it was definitely influential in just the adventurous, risky aspect of game design. And if I remember correctly from Indie Game the Movie, he made the comment about how it's this incredibly personal thing, and with the big AAA games, you take that and you file down all the sharp edges and you make sure no one gets hurt, whereas with indie games, you don't do that at all. It is what it is, and it is there to be experienced as the developer made it.
It doesn't make any sense to do market testing if you're just making art, if you're making a personal expression. Having seen Indie Game the Movie and all that, do you think Braid has a special place in this aspect of indie games, or do you think it's more interesting from the perspective of like mechanics and development?
I think it's very clear that it was a personal story to him, but I feel like it kind of takes a bit of digging to see it for that, just because the focus is very heavy on the mechanics, and then beyond that, the story, and then past that, probably the obscure references to other games or other events or things like that. The personal aspect of it really feels pretty buried underneath it.
With the publicity of things like the movie, the real emphasis, it was in there, he talked about it, but the real focus was on his process and the resources that go into it.
Even then, anything personal about it, regardless of if it's really obvious and explicit in the game or not, that personal experience is what drove the development of the game itself. It's what created the idea in the first place. With any artistic medium, that's going to be the case, and it just goes back to encouraging the personal expression there rather than kind of trying to hide it.
It doesn't have to be like that dragon cancer, where it's explicit about this is my experience. It can be an abstraction of it, a fantastic version of it, or just something that was inspired by the feel of how you were as a person at that moment.
Yeah, exactly.
That about wraps it up for my questions. I'm really excited about some of the ideas we got to hit on.
Sure.
Yeah, that came out of what we were talking about. Thank you very much for taking the time to do this.
Thanks for the opportunity.
I want to ask you, do you ever sit and wonder it's so strange we could be together for so long and never know, never care what goes on in the other one's head? Things I felt but I never said. You said things that I never said, so I'll say something that I should have said long ago.
You don't know me.
You don't know me at all.
You don't know me.
You don't know me at all. You could have just propped me up on the table like a mannequin.
Hi there, Nathan again, checking in for footnotes and a couple of final comments. First of all, I wanted to thank Eric again for taking the time. Great interview guest. Brought up a lot of really good points. based on the conversations we had here, I can see a couple of directions to pursue this further. The first had to do with Eric's example of that dragon cancer and talking about indie games as these intimate art objects and kind of comparing and contrasting it as an explicit version of their experience with it versus something like Braid, which is more impressionistic. It's not hard to imagine, as people continue to make these very personal games, an entire vocabulary of different movements or styles arising to describe the different ways in which people express themselves and discuss their experiences through the medium of games. The other thing I think that you can take away from this is we came in meaning to talk about Braid, but we ended up talking a lot about Jonathan Blow and Indie Game the movie and John Blow's actions as an individual to defend his creation after it was published. I think a more thorough investigation or consideration of... Sometimes we think of art as synonymous with its creator, or a creator as being defined by their art, and I think a more serious interrogation into that, and thinking about why we talk about John Blow so much when we talk about Braid, would really enhance this conversation even further. Footnotes. We've used three songs for this recording. First of all, we had Beauty, parentheses, outro, I Hurt Everybody. I chose this song because I think it does a really good job of capturing what it's like to be a creative person and not have people understand why you do things or what you're trying to express. It goes back to that frustration we were talking about in the immediate aftermath of Braid's release on the part of John Blow and how he was going to people and arguing with them about the meaning. It also speaks to Eric's point a little bit about how indie devs do it for their love of the work, not because it's a job or because it's a way to get famous, and the song expresses some of that. Next up, we had You Don't Know Me by Ben Folds featuring Regina Spektor. It's a little bit ironic because me and Eric have been great friends for 10 years now. It also speaks to some of the conversations we had about other games about games, though. The Beginner's Guide, which is one that we mentioned about halfway through, specifically tackles this idea of trying to understand a game developer as a person through their work, and how it's a futile exercise, and how people will see what they want to see. And this song does a neat job, I think, of expressing how people try to assign personality traits or try to read more deeply into the person based on their work, and how it may not be fair to that person or fair to the work as it stands on its own as an art object. We're going to write out on Timelines by Motion City Soundtrack. I selected this song because, like Braid, it's got explicit references to time and cyclicality and things of that nature, but it also describes different eras in a person's life, and we spent a lot of time talking about different eras in the indie scene and kind of a one-dimensional version of indie, talking about the Indie Game the Movie era, 2008-ish, and how things change over time, and how the indie community is continuing to evolve. Thank you for taking the time to listen, and that's it.